And I was like, what the fuck does that mean? I have friends that are firefighters and I know that they use soap.
And she was screaming at me over soup.
Fuck this, I am not ever talking to a Scientologist again. These people are all insane.
I'm putting my bricks in the dumpsters, motherfuckers. Do you see me, bitches? I'm throwing my bricks. And he's just like chucking bricks.
Hello and welcome to Talking Shit About, a monthly podcast where I, Elizabeth Whipperman, interview someone about something they love, something they hate, something they've been through, or something they just know a lot about, and hopefully by the end we've all learned something. This is going to be part of a larger series, but it'll be a while before we have the rest of those episodes, so for now, enjoy this part one of Recovery and Rock and Roll with Justin Yates. Since we recorded this episode, Justin has released the new album, Tell Me Something Great, on CD for purchase. Outside of the deluxe packages that he mentions in the episode, you can grab the CD by itself or in a t-shirt hoodie bundle, and I will have the link for that in the show notes. So be sure to check out all of his jazz. And for now, let's go ahead and talk some shit. Everybody, I'm here today with Justin Yates, and we're going to talk about his story. We're going to talk about a lot of music stuff, maybe some addiction. Justin, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I got my coffee. I'm ready to go. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, good to have you here. So let's kind of give a background for who you are and sort of where you're at right now. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your music?
Sure. My name is Justin Yates. I'm an acoustic musician who is living out in California by way of Illinois. I lived in the Chicagoland area for most of my life, but I moved out here because I have some major back problems. So I've been out here for the past, 8 years, give or take. These days I'm just trying to maintain that and maintain my life, my mind, my body, all that fun stuff. And recently I just put out a new EP called Tell Me Something Great, and I'm trying to get my feet back into performing and trying to get out there and just telling people about the release of the new music.
Nice. When was sort of the last time you were actively performing?
The last show that I performed was just about a year ago. I have tendonitis in my right arm, and it's been a problem for years. If anyone's familiar with tendonitis, it's like tennis elbow. Or if you're familiar with baseball terminology, it's what a lot of relief pitchers have. It's basically a repetitive injury that happens to the arm. I've been playing music for a very long time, and it's just kind of part of what happens to some people. And I unfortunately developed tendonitis in my left arm as well. And about a year ago, I played my last two shows, and then I lost all function of my arm for about a year. It just stopped moving. I couldn't bend it in certain ways, or else it felt like there was a stabbing motion in my arm. And since then, I have been on a saga to really get my arm back into working condition. And right now, it's okay. I'm having more good days than I'm having bad days. So I'm trying to get out and I'm performing as much as I can. Little sets, can't be doing a 3-hour sets or anything crazy like that. So I'm just trying to work with what I have these days and trying to make the most of it because, I'm just lucky that I can even use my arm. I feared that it would be the end of me, to be honest.
Wow, that is intense. When did you start playing music? You said you've been playing for a long time.
Yeah, well, I've owned a guitar since I was, like 13 years old, and have played all different types of music throughout the years. But around the age of 25, 26, I decided to focus my time completely around the acoustic guitar. And a little bit after that, I released my first album, The Jig Is Up. And then ever since then, this has been kind of my day job. This is what I do all the time. And I've been able to do some really amazing things over the past decade, aside from, a pandemic that put me down and a back injury and a few other things that, created some sidelines. But I've been able to tour the country a few times and put out numerous releases. And I'm lucky to even be here still doing it after all this time, because I don't fit and, I don't know, conform to a lot of the music industry. So I'm lucky that I found a little pocket of people who support what I do. And yeah, it's a real, real blessing that I'm still able to sit here and talk about this so many years later.
I love hearing from working musicians, like people being able to do the things that they're most passionate about. Like, I want more artists to be able to make money doing what they love. What are some of your influences for your, it doesn't have to necessarily be like for your style of music, but just sort of any musicians or bands, etc., that have inspired you and in just making music in general.
Oh man, that's a question I could probably talk about for a long time, because I was a metalhead for many years, and I listened to a lot of angry music for a very long time. But I also listened to a lot of world music, a lot of acoustic music, bluegrass, electronic music. I'm all over the map. I listen to all different types of music, and I also have a background in broadcasting. I worked at a radio station for 7 years, so I was listening to all different types of music there. So I'd like to think that I pull influences from all across the board, but on my electronic press kit, I usually tell people that my influences these days that resemble the music that I play would be Nickel Creek, John Mayer, Jason Mraz, Andy McKee, The Devil Makes Three, just to name a few.
So, I'm curious. We've had a few musicians on the show, and we've talked a little bit about what the pandemic was like in terms of creating. How did quarantine affect your creativeness and productivity when it comes to music?
It was horrible. It was absolutely horrible. And I contribute that, as well as a few other factors, to really putting me into a position of complete obscurity. It was really tough, because I worked, I guess the short of it is this back issue that happened, it happened in Illinois, and it caused me to, I was basically crawling to the bathroom. I couldn't move. It was made me completely handicapped. I was sleeping on a piece of wood. My body was having multiple spasms all over the place for about a year and a half straight. I couldn't sleep at night. It was absolutely insane. And during that process, I wrote an album, and then I relocated to California. And I worked really, really hard to basically start deadlifting and lifting weights and moving around and getting back to performing. And I was able to play more than a handful of shows here in the near the Sacramento area when I got here. And then the pandemic hit, and it just completely handicapped me again in so many different ways. I wasn't able to leave. I wasn't able to really do much. So it really killed an album cycle. And working from home, let's just say I didn't get into making music to play music into the camera on my telephone. So while many people were doing Zoom concerts and TikTok videos and things like that, I found it very depressing. And I fell into a huge depression. And I tried to do as much as I could from home. I tried to make as much money as I could from home. And it was a real, real challenge. And it set me back from weight gain to mental health problems to a whole bunch. And I still feel like to this day, I'm still trying to crawl out of that hole. But I can look back on it and know that it actually helped me in a few ways, because I think it helped pushed me to getting my most recent diagnosis. I think it pushed me to kind of coming to the understanding that I did with a lot of things. And that helped the writing process of the latest EP that I put out. And yeah, there's definitely some silver lining to it, but it was intense. And I'm a very small fish in a huge sea in regards to playing music. I'm definitely a nobody in the scheme of it all. And so there was a lot of avenues that a lot of musicians were able to capitalize on during the pandemic, and I definitely did not have those. But I tried to do as much as I could. And looking back on it, it was a hit. But I think all in all, it was probably a good thing, because I think it helped, like I said, reframe my perspectives and mindset in many different ways.
So did you struggle with your mental health before all of this health stuff started?
Oh, yeah. I've been in and out of therapy since I was like 10 years old. It's been many different issues throughout the years, different diagnosis. I always tell people that therapy is something that right now is really helpful for me, but it's been a journey. And throughout my life, I mean, I've seen well over 30 different, you know, psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers, caregivers, all these different labels of people. And it's been an ongoing thing.
Do you think like these different periods of, you know, getting different levels of care or dealing with these certain health issues? Obviously, we talked about the pandemic stint, but do you feel like the mental health struggles affect like your creative process?
Yes. I think the short answer to that is yes. The long answer is talking about the entire creation of my first album, which I am trying to put into written form, hopefully in the near future here. But that's a whole other tale in itself. But yeah, all of the music under my name, this and doing it in the acoustic realm, is really all about mental health. And it has to speak about different relationships and coming into your own and the trials and tribulations that kind of come with life in a cynical yet optimistic way. And I, whether I knew it or not, was using music as a therapeutic tool and still do to a degree. And I've been lucky enough to work on session work and work in other projects where I can compose music and approach it from many different aspects, but the music that I do under my name and the past couple albums that I do are all from a very emotional point, I guess you could say. And it does help, it does influence, and it's also difficult because I'm not just going out and singing, you know, songs. I'm not going out and playing Jesse's Girl. When I go out and to perform, I'm really bearing a lot of myself in its raw form in the songs. And that can be a lot for people as well as a lot for myself. But I believe that that's what I bring to the table. And as intense as it might be, it's as honest as I can possibly be with what I do.
Is there a song you could kind of give us an example of?
Yeah. I mean, the single off the first album, Lower Your Tone, is definitely one that embodies that. But almost every song on the second album really came from a very dark place, being locked inside of a one bedroom apartment while dealing with these back issues. That was definitely something that I had to use as a therapeutic tool, for better or for worse. But, the most recent album in itself is definitely, a prime example of it. From the name of the album to the self-titled track, it definitely deals with mental health and trying to pour more and more of that into the songs these days.
So yeah, in addition, well, I guess that it sort of is a mental health aspect, but would you be comfortable talking, well, I guess, sorry, I just asked you that. Could you talk about the role addiction played in your creative process and sort of, I guess, just in general?
Well, I guess in the creative process, I think it helped me in the sense that it would help me disassociate and help me kind of become numb to the chaos that was happening in my life enough that I could put my mind into the music that I was making to be able to use that as an outlet. And if I wasn't numbing myself, I don't think I'd be able to focus on that or anything. I think the mental health issues I'm having and the chaos that is my life would be too much for me to even focus on music. So in some ways, that numbing aspect, I guess, helped. I don't think it, I don't know. Some people always say that certain drugs will spawn creativity. And I don't think I ever really had that, or at least I never really felt that way, where if I was on some sort of narcotic that I was like, oh, give me a keyboard or something. And then I, you know, really get into it. It's, I don't feel it's that way. I think I get into music just in general. And when I get into an idea, I get into an idea. I don't think I need some narcotic. Actually, some narcotics that I've done in the past have made me not even want to pick up an instrument. I can't focus at all because I'm completely out of it. But I've been on one substance or another since I was about 13 years old. And I turned 40 this year. And I'm creeping up on 2 years of sobriety, even though I've stopped doing a lot of narcotics for many years now. I'm just not smoking anything anymore, which is really, really difficult. And I hate it. But I'm really trying. So that's an everyday type of battle. But yeah, I've been a drug addict mainly my whole life, as odd as that is to say, but it's something I'm coming to terms with and something I'm trying to deal with as much as I can.
2 years is good. So congrats on that. That's
thank you.
Seriously impressive.
I hate it. It's the worst. I seriously hate it, which is why I'm in like hardcore therapy and have been in therapy. Well, that and other reasons for the past like 2 years nonstop, but most people, you know, really have a lot of self-compassion and a lot of self-love, and they can really be happy because they're taking care of themselves. And I think that's where a lot of therapy is helping me, because I don't care, being completely honest. And that's not a good thing. And I understand that. Also, when you smoke cigarettes or you smoke weed all the time, it's definitely a crutch. And I suffer from a bunch of different diagnoses, and having that crutch every day is very helpful, even if it's not helpful, but the perspective of it is helpful. Not having that every day and just taking life straight to the face, I really have a lot of, I don't know the right word, appreciation, or I'm really impressed by sober people who can just take life constantly. And obviously they have a different, you know, experience in life than I do, and a different perspective than I do. But just taking it every day, it's, yeah, I have a lot of appreciation for that.
Me too. So you're not smoking cigarettes either?
No, I'm not doing anything. I mean, being completely honest, I've done psilocybin probably like 7 or 8 times throughout the past 2 years, but that is an extremely small, almost microdose level, and more on a like medicinal and therapeutic type setting, where I'm taking diligent notes and going over it with therapists and basically using it as something to help with the trauma that I've gone through and some of the things that I'm doing. But yeah, about 2 years ago, I stopped all medication that I was on. I stopped smoking. I stopped everything. And, it sucks. It's like, it's the best word to use, because I really enjoy smoking, but it is a good thing. And I am still surprised that I'm not smoking right now. I'm really surprised. And as more things come up, I'm still surprised I haven't just gone out and bought cigarettes yet. I really don't know where that, I don't know where that drive is coming from, where that motivation to not smoke is coming from. But I think that's a credit to that therapy is working.
Yeah. I'm sure I will overlay the actual statistic later, but there are a large majority of people in recovery smoke cigarettes. Are you ready for some estimated statistics? It is estimated that about 85% of people in alcohol recovery smoke cigarettes, compared to about 25% of the general public. And people in recovery who smoke cigarettes are more likely to die from tobacco-related illnesses. So
I am one of these folks. I have been smoking cigarettes, now vaping, unfortunately, on and off since I was 15. 4 years sober from alcohol, though, so that's a win. I should really try to quit vaping. Anyways, back to the interview.
It's just like a thing. So seriously, congrats on that one. Smoked cigarettes on and off since I was like 15. And anytime I wanted to quit, I would just go cold turkey. And then the last time I wanted to quit before my wedding 2 years ago, and I was like, oh, I'll just switch to the vape. And I have not been able to stop those stupid things. So whatever you do, don't start vaping. Because it is way harder to quit than cigarettes.
I have a really addictive personality. And I know some people believe that genetically there is no predisposition, if that's the correct term. Some people think that there is. My family tree has a huge line of addicts in it. And I myself know that I have a very addictive personality. And I was vaping for a while. And then I just noticed that I was just vaping in between every time I would have a cigarette. And I'm just like, oh, I'm just smoking twice as much now. This is ridiculous. So I had to stop that. And I couldn't wean off of one or the other, but I tried multiple times to do nicotine lozenges, and those seem to work a little bit, but I honestly think what pushed me over the edge is I'm very much, by the textbook definition, a struggling or starving artist. And it's very hard for me to do anything in this life because money rules everything. I had a pretty nasty tooth issue that happened, and I had somebody financially help me basically get like two implants in my mouth so that my face wouldn't get messed up and I could actually hopefully still sing and chew food in my later years. And I honestly think that the guilt from thinking that if I continuously smoke, it's going to ruin their generosity, I think that actually helped me not smoke, to be honest with you. It wasn't even me. I think it was that influence of somebody else caring about what's going on, which, if you look at that at a psychological level, is really messed up. But it helped me, I think, and it showed me that it's like I respect you more than I respect myself, which is not good. But I can use that as a motivation. I think that helped me that first year to really focus on it. And I know you were saying, you know, statistically, a lot of people smoke who are in recovery. I think my current problem is overeating, which I'm trying to work on. But the turnaround rate for people in recovery is like 95% of people relapse. You know what I mean? So it's understandable. And that's why I'm kind of baffled that it's like I still haven't smoked yet. I don't know why. But again, I think it has to do with the therapy that I'm doing.
And yeah, honestly, I would push back a little bit that you said it was like bad that, you know, you were more concerned about your, you know, this person who paid for your teeth versus like doing it for yourself. I think that's like healthy peer pressure, although it's like technically, I guess, sort of pressure you're putting on yourself. But maybe it's just because I'm connecting too much with your mindset, and like, so I'm a little biased. But I don't know. I think there can be like some healthy peer pressure for sure. But
no, I do as well. And I know where you're coming from. And I think that, you know, sometimes if you're a person who doesn't have that strong will in themselves, if that's what we want to call it, you know, getting that motivation from an outside source is a great thing. And I mean, people do it all the time, from family to friends to religion to all different types of things. So I don't think it's a bad thing, but I think it does reflect a lot of me internally. And it also kind of reminds me, and hopefully you'll get the parallel here, is, you know, it reminds me of the difference between like self-compassion and self-esteem. One of them is clearly coming from you. The other one is coming from an outside influence. And though they both can produce really good results, I think most, you know, 9 out of 10 doctors will say working on your self-compassion is going to be a heck of a lot more rewarding than operating off of self-esteem, which is given by others. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
So have there been any specific therapies that have been helpful?
I mean, yes and no. I've been in and out of therapy, like I said, for most of my life. But a little bit over 2 years ago, I was diagnosed with borderline personality disorder, which is interesting based on the previous diagnosis that I had. But it made a lot of sense. And when you listen to the music that I write or people talk to me, I think it becomes abundantly clear that I'm a little bit different than other people, for better or for worse. And when I got that diagnosis, I was in a pretty bad place. And this is when I was writing my most recent album. And I kind of decided that I needed to throw myself into anything and everything that I possibly could, or else like I knew where I would be heading because I've been there before. And I was like, I'm not going to allow myself to get there because it's going to be very bad. So I threw myself into basically therapy 5 days a week. And at that point in time, I was doing individual therapy basically twice a week. I was doing dialectical behavioral therapy in a group setting, as well as individual dialectical behavioral therapy. And those DBT classes were okay. And I learned a lot from there that was really helpful. But I ended up stopping the group and the individual sessions basically because of the woman who was teaching it. She was horrible. And that's not just a personal opinion. I took the first person who could help me. Then I ended up finding out that she has like a 1.2 rating online. And like, I remember one of her reviews online where somebody was like, I have more problems now after I went to your classes. And I was just like, whoa. But I got a bunch of good literature from there. And the therapist that I'm seeing now is amazing. And it's a really funny story. She's given me a whole bunch of literature. I've had to have read like 25 books over the past 2 years, on a whole bunch of different forms of therapy, from somatic work to breath work to all different types of stuff. But, it was really funny. I talked to my health insurance and I was like, listen, I need to see a different therapist. I have this new diagnosis. I need to talk to somebody. I think it's really important. And I'm like, I'm just having a hard time holding on to everything. And they go, okay, well, we can set you up with someone who has a background with borderline personality disorder and extreme depression and the other diagnoses that you have, or we can give you somebody who's new. And I was like, huh. And I think in a moment of just me kind of at the end of my rope, I go, you know what? Give me the new kid. I was like, I'll give him something. Like I almost took it as like a challenge where I'm like, I'm going to break this person. And like, that's not good, but it just showed you on how like off I was at the time. And it was one of the best decisions that I've made in the past 2 years. And I don't know if it was just the person themselves and how lovely they are, or if it's the fact that they're just green and they just came out as like schooling and everything is fresh and they've got just a great passion. They're not worn down by the system. And for anyone who's listening, who has been to different therapists over the years, they've probably met people who are like that, where you might go in for an assessment and they don't even look at you. They're following some checklist. They're completely checked out. They're waiting for 5 o'clock to hit. I never got that impression with this person, and the work that we have been doing and just their presence in my life has literally changed so much. And I'm really, really grateful for that, because I was in a pretty bad place, and they definitely helped me get to a place that's a little bit better these days. That's for sure.
That's so great. And such a good, important point that we've brought up on the show before, and we'll bring it up again. If you ever try therapy or a group and you don't like it, it's totally fine to shop around. Never settle for a shitty therapist if you have to, or if you don't have to.
It's really odd that we have these hiring protocols for so many different jobs, but there are so many different therapists out there that don't go through that same, I don't know what the right word is, vetting. Yeah. And I've seen so many different people where their intentions are great, but their motivations are somewhere else, or they're just, I don't know, a part of a system that they don't even want to try to push back on. And I think that even people who haven't gone to therapy might be able to see that within their boss or might remember that from being in academia, depending on what level you've gone to. I bet you've seen that too, where certain teachers will be stifled or almost accommodating to their curriculum rather than taking a second to actually speak to you. And that's a huge factor for some people. They need to be seen. They need to be heard. They need to be spoken to. They need to connect with somebody, not just having a soundboard regurgitate something out of a book. And, you know, to actually find a therapist recently, like I said, I don't know if it's just her or if she's green or what it is, but to have somebody actually take the time, it's been life-changing.
I should start doing this next question before that question, because it always feels like a Debbie Downer. But what are some of the challenges or barriers in your recovery? Like, is there anything that you tend to avoid or just things that present an extra challenge?
Yeah, the profession that I do. Like, I'm not a household name. I've had the opportunity of opening up for Grammy award-winning acts. I've played nationally. I've played on bigger stages to smaller stages, from playing in front of hundreds of people to playing in front of no people. So I've had the experience of doing a lot, but because I am smaller, that means I have to kind of play in different markets. I have to be around alcohol a lot. I have to be around people who, let's just say music is the last concern that they have. And so there's a lot of outside influence and pressure from different temptations. And going out is difficult, because on one hand, my aspirations make me want to grow, make me want to get the music out there, want to perform. And the other side of me is like, I don't want to go spend my time at a bar. Mm-hmm. I don't want to go spend my time around people who are at a bar with different motives than are there to just listen to music. And it's a constant battle. Also, there's a huge part of myself that doesn't trust myself. And I know that I am constantly fighting different urges and just putting myself into those situations. I can just feel the temptation to just be an outlaw, as I put it. And I really have to kind of protect myself. But it's difficult, because as much as you want to protect yourself by putting yourself in a bubble, you also are creating a tomb for yourself. And that's not good either. So still to this day, I'm trying to find a really good balance between the two. And as anyone knows, it gets harder the older that you are to make friends, find places to just go hang out. And a lot of places like that are bars, are places that have outside stimuli. And I've never been a huge drinker, but most people who know that, you know, bars are meeting places for all types of different things. So it's a hard balance, and it's one that I'm still struggling to find, because truth be told, I can't make a living playing at coffee houses, even though I love playing at cafes. It's a little bit harder, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an excellent point about the alcohol at venues. That is, so when I was in college, I worked at a radio station and I did a lot of like promoting and stuff. And I got, like, shortly before the pandemic, I got roofied at a show. And it was like a DIY venue. It was always super fun. It was like supposed to be like quote unquote safe space. And I was not the only person that got roofied there, but after that I was like, I don't want to be around alcohol at all. And there were no dry venues in Missoula. There used to be one where it was like an all ages venue, but then they moved locations and remodeled and put in a bar. And we were doing like our annual fundraiser, and the rest of the staff, bless them, they were like, okay, well, what can we do where there's not like alcohol? Like, where can we? And I was like, if we want people to show up, there's got to be alcohol. Like, that is just the reality of it. That's why I had alcohol at my wedding, is because I knew like a lot of people wouldn't show up. I don't know about a lot of people, but you know, maybe not stick around for the whole thing if I didn't provide like beer and wine. But it's just so ingrained in our culture. So I definitely feel you on that one.
Well, first let me say, I'm really sorry to hear that you had to deal with that. That is unbelievably traumatic and crazy to hear. And I'm so sorry. And that did, I hope they caught the person responsible. That is intense. Are you okay? Is that still something that you're dealing with to this day, I imagine?
Yes and no. I still definitely don't like drinking around strangers.
I meant to say here, I don't like being around strangers who are drinking.
We didn't have any like hard evidence of the person, but we, through sleuthing, were pretty sure who it was, got them blacklisted from the venue. The venue's response was actually phenomenal. They set up an entirely different system for how they distributed alcohol and like reached out to me and some of the other people. Luckily for me, it was, so I had like one drink on my way there and then like a beer. And I was a very heavy drinker. So for me, that was like nothing. And then all of a sudden it was like, I was just like fucked up. I like was like projectile vomiting. I was like, I couldn't think straight. And I was like, so embarrassed. I was like, I can't believe I got this drunk. And then I was trying to get an Uber to go home and I couldn't read my phone, which is like one of the biggest red flags, because like I would drink and read or drink and write. So like drinking usually didn't inhibit me in that way. And so that was very unusual that I like couldn't even open up Uber. So I remember starting to walk home and then I was in my bed the next day, like fully dressed, and was like, whoa, what just happened? And then I was like trying to go about my day. Had like an actual like flashback where I felt like I was back in the night before and I was super disoriented. And I was like looking up, I was like Googling like, you know, symptoms of being roofied and stuff. And then I put something out on Facebook and two other people were like, oh, me too, here's what happened. And then another friend was followed home by the person that we're pretty sure did it. Wow. And yeah, the newspaper ended up picking it up. They didn't interview me, which I thought was kind of annoying, but since I'm like the one that brought it to light, but whatever. I made the big mistake of reading the comment section. So advice to anybody, don't do that. But yeah, I'm kind of like in a similar boat where I don't really like to be at bars and stuff. Like if I have to go, I will, or like, you know, but a lot of it, yeah, is that sort of self, like, I don't want to put myself in a position where I might slip up. So that's definitely relatable for sure.
Well, again, I am so sorry to hear that you had to deal with something like that, because that is intense. And I'm really glad to hear that they at least, you know, through some detective work, were able to find the person responsible. Yeah, that's intense. But to your point, yeah, see, like when you were saying, you know, that all ages venue, was, you know, wanted to keep doing certain things, but you were like, we're not going to be able to get people out. And that's a huge thing. Like there's a lot of people out there who can make a living at making music and sell tickets. And there's a lot of people who don't, and they're working musicians, but it's hard to get people out to venues. I think you can understand why a lot of musicians kind of fall to doing cover music, and they kind of, I want to say, like, pander to the audience and to the venue owners because they want to do what the mass majority of people are wanting in there. And it becomes a risk bringing in original artists because, you know, the audience isn't there just for the music. They're there to unwind and have a drink after work. And you are the background to what they are doing. And that's why for some musicians, including myself, it's kind of hard to be able to find these little pockets of being able to make any sort of financial profit, or having your time even be accommodated at all, unless you are there selling drinks for people. So it's a difficult situation, and Obviously, there are pockets where you can sell tickets and get to all ages venues, but it's it that becomes difficult too because you need to be a bigger name to pull people out, and it's a struggle that a lot of musicians have to deal with. No, I was just saying, I guess to that point of, you know, being an addict who has to swim in certain seas and be able to still operate, you're going to have to find ways to kind of be in those environments, because those are the only environments that will be financially supporting what you're doing. Because the long and short of it is that there are less and less people buying physical merchandise and less people going out to independent shows. And, you know, unless you're a huge name that has a huge draw, it can be a real challenge. So you're going to be finding yourself in some of these environments that might be, they could bring a lot of stressors to a recovering addict, you could say.
Well, that's actually a perfect segue into the next question I was going to ask you, which is what are some of the ways that you practice like self-care in addition to therapy, which is fantastic, but what are some of the ways that you take care of yourself to keep your mental health in check in our turbulent times?
It's still something that I battle with constantly because the issues that I have are ongoing, and I don't know that they'll ever be like fixed. So it's always something that I'm working on. Like this week I went to, a holotropic breathwork class. I'm constantly doing meditation. I try to work out as much as I can because that's definitely something that's really good for mental health. I really try to read. I try to do my best to give myself self-compassion and try to give myself space and time, because the more overstimulated I am, the more that I see that these problems rise up. And I really just try to do my best to work these little things, from doing, like I said, breathing exercises to meditation, therapy, really just anything and anything I can get at my disposal. Reading a lot of literature lately has been very, very helpful. It's just gaining more knowledge is something that is helping me kind of just hold everything. But I really gotta credit the therapy that I'm doing, which has been very, very helpful. Also, the people around me have become also very aware of how they interact with the world. And the more that they're in tune with themselves, for better or worse, is the more that they can be in tune with the people around them as well. And that environment has become a lot more stable and complimenting, and that makes a huge difference for my well-being day to day, because it's every day is really hard. There's definitely a war inside of myself that I'm constantly fighting, so it's to have a support structure around me is a very, very huge thing.
Before I throw you my kind of wrap-up question, I just wanted to open the floor. There's anything that came up while we were talking, or something that I didn't ask that you were hoping I would, just going to give you the floor if there's anything you wanted to chat about.
One of the biggest things that's just going on right now for me is really just trying to get the word out about the new album that I put out, which is called Tell Me Something Great. And I know it's a little unconventional, but it's not available online. It's not available for streaming. It's only available for purchase. Speaking of self-worth, I feel that the music that I make is worth more than fractions of a penny. And as a person who's a small-time fish in a big sea, I can't live off streaming royalties that are laughable. So I'm encouraging people to check out the music that I do have available on streaming sites. And if they like what they hear, to check out the new commercial that I put out advertising the new album, and to hopefully invest into it. And right now I've had kind of like these packages that I've been working on for the past while that have the CD and a whole bunch of other goodies from, I basically created like an apparel line and a toy line for this album. And those packages are out right now, but they're an extremely limited quantity, and they're just about sold out. I'm really just trying to get the word out about that music. I kind of went through hell and back to be able to create it, and it's something I'm really proud of. It's different for me because all my music has been acoustic based, but this album is basically three full band songs with drums and everything like that. And then they also have the acoustic versions of them as well. It was recorded in Chicago, Illinois, with the producer Dustin Bennett. And yeah, it's definitely trying something different, but the songs themselves took a long time to write. And like I said, I kind of went through hell and back to get them done. And I'm really excited to get them out there and trying to get them into the ears of people who will appreciate it and really want to take a listen. And yeah, just really trying to kind of push those out there. Hopefully we can sneak in a couple of those audio samples throughout the interview. And if people like what they hear, you know, check me out at justinyates.com. Come say hi. I'm really easy to get a hold of. And yeah.
Yeah. And I will be sure to include links to all of that in the show notes and sprinkle in some music so folks can get a taste. So my kind of closing question that I like to ask people is, do you have any advice for your younger self? And younger can be, you know, 2 years ago, Justin, or it can be like 15 years ago, Justin, but anything you would just tell your younger self to kind of guide you on the right path, or just anything you probably wanted to or needed to hear but didn't hear?
It's an interesting question. I don't know how to encapsulate everything I would want to say to a younger me in such a small way. I would probably say that if you listen to, as cliche as it sounds, like listening to your heart, listening to what's inside of you and not letting outside influence impact you as much as it has. I've held a lot of people really close and have been hurt by a lot of people. And it's truly affected me in a lot of ways that I wish I could say that it hasn't. And if I was able to tell younger me to follow what I'm feeling inside and not be swayed by that, I think it would have made a huge difference. I also might tell them that music might not be the ultimate way to connect with people in the way that I want to, which is something that I'm coming to terms with these days, trying to think about going back to school to try to get into social work or something else, because I want to be able to help people with my experience. And it might be a little bit, I don't know the right word. It's hard to reach people through music, and I might have suggested to myself to follow some different avenues as well as still pursuing music, but trying to follow some different avenues that would be a little bit difficult. And I guess tying this back around, when we're talking about like performing in a bar, when you're playing in a bar and you're writing very emotional music, you know, it might penetrate one or two people at the bar. And I'd like to be able to find ways to be able to kind of cross that level and connect with people a little bit differently. And struggling in those realms to find that through music has always been a challenge. It's been a cathartic one and I've been able to do it, but I think there's many ways to skin a cat. And so I would tell them to kind of keep an open mind and try a bunch of different avenues. But man, there's a lot of things I'd like to tell younger Justin, but I don't know if I can, I think I have to deal with where I'm at right now instead of vicariously thinking I could change the past, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So Justin, thank you so much for coming on the show and being so vulnerable and let me kind of pick your brain. And again, we'll just do one more recap. If people want to find your music, how can they do that?
I would say just go to justinyates.com. You can find me on Spotify and iTunes and all that kind of stuff. But to be honest, I don't know how long my music's going to be up there for. So you can find me at justinyates.com. And yeah, everything is there. Links and merchandise and videos and all kinds of fun stuff.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, Justin.
Sure. Thank you for having me. Have a great day.
You too.
Since this recording, Justin has released the new album, Tell Me Something Great, on CD for purchase, outside of the deluxe packages he mentioned. You can grab the CD by itself or in a t-shirt or hoodie bundle, and I'll have the links to that in the show notes.
If you enjoyed the show, there are a few ways you can support me. You can follow me on all of the podcasting platforms, turn on automatic downloads, follow me on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. And if you have $2 a month to spare, you can join my Patreon at patreon.com/talkingshitabout. And there will be merch coming soon. I don't have a date, but it's coming. I'm working on it.
It's all designed by me, a human being. Anyways, I hope you enjoyed this episode. We'll be back in 2 weeks for a microsode and then back again in February for another interview. Thanks for listening. Then I think of all the things I've lost and what they meant to me. Where the hell were you when I needed you? So now a journey inside, I'm trying to chase these demons. What is building in me? And it feels like there's nothing left, but now I know it can be okay. See, I've been reminiscing over some things I've been missing and focusing on the lies. So tell me something great, my dear, cause I'ma need this to stay alive. Best days are behind us. What the hell are we fighting?